from. The first part, Vil, is from...
This is Eli.
This is Esme.
This is Everett.
We're from Maryville.
This is Ethel. I'm from Maplewood.
You're listening to WGSC.
90.7 FM.
Catskill, Hudson.
Creative
Community Radio.
This is Carmen Borgia.
And John Sturman. We're the hosts of Ukuleles Unleashed,
where you'll hear...
And also...
Tiptoe through the tulips.
And also...
And some of this. There's always...
And remember this thing?
I'll grow when you...
Tune in the third Tuesday of each month from 8 to 10 p.m. for Ukuleles Unleashed
on WGXC 90.7. Acre.
Wave Farm programs are made possible in part by the New York State Council on the Arts, with the support of the New York State Legislature, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts, the Greene County Legislature through the County Initiative Program, administered in Greene County by CREATE, the Alexander and Marjorie Hoover Foundation, the T. Backer Fund, the Joseph Family Charitable Trust, and hundreds of other generous individual donors, including WGXC's sustaining supporters, who provide critical monthly support to Wave Farm's radio station, WGXC 90.7 FM. Thank you.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Cornelius Eady of New York, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends and enemies. You're listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas, and the name of the show is Good Night, Norman, right here on WGXC, Radio for the People, 90.7 FM, broadcasting studio in Catskill, New York. Streaming presence on the worldwide interweb at wgxc.org. Right now, I'm going to bring you some fiction because it's the only true thing left. This is called The Adventure of a Soldier. And it was written a long time ago by a man who's no longer on the planet, at least not under the name that he had assumed previously, Italo Calvino. The Adventure of a Soldier. In the compartment, a lady came and sat down, tall and buxom, next to Private Tanagra. She must have been a widow from the provinces, to judge by her dress and her veil. The dress was black silk, appropriate for prolonged mourning, but with useless frills and furbelows, and the veil went all around her face, falling from the brim of a massive, old-fashioned hat. Other places were free there in the compartment, Private Tanagra noticed, and he had assumed the widow would surely choose one of them. But on the contrary, despite the vicinity of a coarse soldier like himself, she came and sat right there. No doubt, for some reason connected with travel, the soldier quickly decided a draft or the direction of the train. Her body was in full bloom, solid, indeed, a bit square. If its upper curves had not been tempered by a matronly softness, you would have said she was no more than 30. But when you looked at her face, at the complexion both marmoreal and relaxed, the unattainable gaze beneath the heavy eyelids and the thick black brows, at the sternly sealed lips, hastily colored with a jarring red. She seemed instead past 40. Tanagra, a young infantryman on his first leave. It was Easter, huddled down in his seat for fear that the lady, so ample and shapely, might not fit. Immediately he found himself in the aura of her perfume, a popular and perhaps cheap scent, but now, out of long wear, blended with natural human odors. The lady sat down with a composed demeanor, revealing there beside him less majestic proportions than he had imagined when he had seen her standing. Her hands were plump, with tight, dark rings. She kept them folded in her lap, over a shiny purse and a jacket she had taken off to expose round, white arms. At her first movement, Tanagra had shifted to make space for a broad maneuvering of her arms, but she had remained almost motionless, slipping out of the sleeves with a few brief twitches of her shoulders and torso. The railroad seat was therefore fairly comfortable for two, and Tanagra could feel the lady's extreme closeness, though without any fear of offending her by his contact. All the same, Tanagra reasoned, lady though she was, she had surely not shown any sign of repugnance toward him, toward his rough uniform. Otherwise, she would have sat further away. And at these thoughts, his muscles, till now contracted and tensed, relaxed freely, serenely. Indeed, without his moving, they tried to expand to their greatest extension, and his leg, its tendons taut, at first detached even from the cloth of his trousers, settled more broadly, tightening the material that covered it, and the wool grazed the widow's black silk. And now, through this wool and that silk, the soldier's leg was adhering to her leg with a soft, fleeting motion, like one shark grazing another and sending waves through its veins to those other veins. Excuse me. It was still a very light contact, which every jolt of the train could break off and recreate. The lady had strong, fat knees, and Tanagra's bones could sense at every jerk the lazy bump of the kneecap. The calf had raised a silken cheek that, with an imperceptible thrust, had to be made to coincide with his own. This meeting of calves was precious, but it came at a price, a loss. In fact, the body's weight was shifted, and the reciprocal support of the hips no longer occurred with the same docile abandon. In order to achieve a natural and satisfied position, it was necessary to move slightly on the seat with the aid of a curve in the track, and also of the comprehensible need to shift position every so often. The lady was impassive beneath her matronly hat, her gaze fixed, lidded, and her hand steady on the purse in her lap. And yet her body, for a very long stretch, rested against that stretch of man. Hadn't she realized this yet? Or was she preparing to flee, to rebel? Tanagra decided to transmit, somehow, a message to her. He contracted the muscle of his calf into a kind of hard, square fist. And then, with this calf fist, as if a hand inside it wanted to open, he quickly knocked at the calf of the widow. To be sure, this was a very rapid movement, barely long enough for a flicker of the tendons. But in any case, she didn't draw back, at least not so far as he could tell, because immediately, needing to justify that covert movement, Tanagra extended his leg, as if to get a kink out of it. Now he had to begin all over again. That patient and prudently established contact had been lost. Tanagra decided to be more courageous, as if looking for something. He stuck his hand in his pocket, the pocket toward the woman, and then, as if absently, he left it there. It had been a rapid action. Tanagra didn't know whether he had touched her or not, an inconsequential gesture, yet he now realized what an important step forward he had made, and in what a risky game he was now involved. Against the back of his hand, the hip of the lady in black was now pressing. He felt it weighing on every finger, every knuckle. Now any movement of his hand would have been an act of incredible intimacy toward the widow. Holding his breath, Tanagra turned his hand inside his pocket. In other words, he set the palm toward the lady, open against her, though still in that pocket. It was an impossible position, the wrist twisted. And yet, at this point, he might just as well attempt a decisive action. And so he ventured to move the fingers of that contorted hand. There could no longer be any possible doubt. The widow couldn't have helped noticing his maneuvering, and if she didn't draw back, but pretended to be impassive and absent, it meant that she wasn't rejecting his advances. When Tanagra thought about it, however, her paying no attention to his mobile right hand might mean that she really believed he was hunting for something in that pocket, a railroad ticket, a match. There, and if now, the soldier's fingertips, the pads, seemingly endowed with a sudden clairvoyance, could sense through those different stuffs the items of subterranean garments, and even the very minute roughness of skin, pores and moles. If, as I said, his fingertips arrived at this, perhaps her flesh, marmoreal and lazy, was hardly aware that these were in fact fingertips and not, for example, nails or knuckles. Then, with furtive steps, the hand emerged from the pocket, paused there undecided, and with sudden haste to adjust the trouser along the side seam, proceeded all the way down to the knee. More precisely, it cleared a path. To go forward, it had to dig in between himself and the woman, a route that, even in its speed, was rich in anxieties and sweet emotions. It must be said that Tanagra had thrown his head back against the seat, so one might also here have thought he was sleeping. This was not so much an alibi for himself as it was a way of offering the lady, in the event that his insistence didn't irritate her, a reason to feel at ease, knowing that his actions were divorced from his consciousness, barely surfacing from the depths of sleep. And there, from his alert semblance of sleep, Tanagra's hand, clutching his knee, detached one finger and sent it out to reconnoiter. The finger slid along her knee, which remained still and docile. Tanagra could perform diligent figures with the little finger on the silk of the stocking, which through his half-closed eyes he could barely glimpse, light and curving. But he realized that the risk of this game was without reward, because the little finger, scant of surface and awkward in movement, transmitted only partial hints of sensations and was incapable of conceiving the form and substance of what it was touching. Then he reattached the little finger to the rest of the hand, not withdrawing it, but adding to it the ring finger, the middle finger, the forefinger. Now his whole hand rested inert on that female knee, and the train cradled it in a rocking caress. It was then that Tanagra thought of the others. If the lady, whether out of compliance or out of a mysterious intangibility, didn't react to his boldness, facing them were still seated other persons who might be scandalized by that non-soldierly behavior of his, and by that possible silent complicity on the woman's part. Chiefly to spare the lady such suspicion, Tanagra withdrew his hand, or rather, he hid it, as if it were the only guilty party. But hiding it, he later thought, was only a hypocritical pretext, and abandoning it there on the seat, he intended simply to move it closer to the lady, who occupied, in fact, such a large part of the space. Excuse me. Indeed, the hand groped around. There, like a butterfly's lighting, the fingers already sensed her presence, and there it was enough merely to thrust the whole palm forward gently. And the widow's gaze beneath the veil was impenetrable, the bosom only faintly stirred by her respiration. But no, Tanagra had already withdrawn his hand like a mouse, scurrying off. She didn't move, he thought. Maybe she wants this. But he also thought, another moment, and it will be too late. Or maybe she's sitting there studying me, preparing to make a scene. Then, for no reason except prudent verification, Tanagra slid his hand along the back of the seat and waited until the train's jolts imperceptibly made the lady slide over his fingers. To say he waited is not correct. Actually, with the tips of his fingers wedge-like between the seat and her, he made an invisible push, which could also have been the effect of the train speeding. If he stopped at a certain point, it wasn't because the lady had given any indication of disapproval, but on the contrary, because Tanagra thought that if she did accept, it would be easy for her, with a half-rotation of the muscles, to meet him halfway, to fall, as it were, on that expectant hand. To suggest to her the friendly nature of his attention, Tanagra, in that position beneath the lady, attempted a discreet wiggle of the fingers. The lady was looking out of the window, and her hand was idly toying with the purse clasp, opening and closing it. Was this a signal to him to stop? Was it a final concession she was granting him, a warning that her patience could be tried no longer? Was it this? Tanagra asked himself. Was it this? He noticed that his hand, like a stubby octopus, was clasping her flesh. Now, all was decided. He could no longer draw back. Not Tanagra. But what about her? She was a sphinx. With a crab's oblique scuttle, the soldier's hand now descended her thigh. Was it out in the open before the eyes of the others? No. Now the lady was adjusting the jacket she held folded on her lap, allowing it to spill to one side, to offer him cover, or to block his path. There. Now the hand moved freely and unseen. It clasped her. It opened in fleeting caresses like brief puffs of wind. But the widow's face was still turned away, distant. Tanagra stared at a part of her, a zone of naked skin between the ear and the curve of his full chignon. And in that dimple beneath the ear, a vein throbbed. This was the answer she was giving him, clear, heart-rending, and fleeting. She turned her face all of a sudden, proud and marmoreal. The veil hanging below the hat stirred like a curtain. The gaze was lost beneath the heavy lids. But that gaze had gone past him, Tanagra, perhaps had not even grazed him. She was looking beyond him, at something or nothing, the pretext of some thought, But anyway, something more important than he. This he decided later, because earlier, when he had barely seen that movement of hers, he had immediately thrown himself back and shut his eyes tight, as if he were asleep, trying to quell the flush spreading over his face, and thus perhaps losing the opportunity to catch in the first glint of her eyes an answer to his own extreme doubts. His hand, hidden under the black jacket, had remained as if detached from him, numb, the fingers drawn back toward the wrist, no longer a real hand, now without sensitivity beyond that arboreal sensitivity of the bones. But as the truce the widow had granted to her own impassivity with that vague glance around soon ended, blood and courage flowed back into the hand. And it was then that resuming contact with that soft saddle of leg, he realized he had reached a limit. The fingers were running along the hem of the skirt, beyond which there was the leap to the knee and the void. It was the end, Private Tanagra thought, of this secret spree. Thinking back, he found it truly a poor thing in his memory, though he had greedily blown it up while experiencing it. A clumsy feel of a silk dress, something that could in no way have been denied him simply because of his miserable position as a soldier, and something that the lady had discreetly condescended, without any show, to concede. He was interrupted, however, in his desolate intention of withdrawing his hand when he noticed the way she was holding her jacket on her knees. No longer folded, though it had seemed so to him before, but flung carelessly, so that one edge fell in front of her legs. His hand was thus in a sealed den, perhaps a final proof of the trust the lady was giving him, confident that the disparity between her station and the soldier's was so great that he surely wouldn't take advantage of the opportunity. And the soldier recalled, with effort, what had happened so far between the widow and himself as he tried to discover something in her behavior that hinted at further condescension. Now he considered whether his own actions had been insignificant and trivial, casual grazings and strokings, or, on the other hand, of a decisive intimacy, committing him not to withdraw again. His hand surely agreed with this second consideration, because before he could reflect on the irreparable nature of the act, he was already passing the frontier. And the lady, she was asleep. She had rested her head, with a pompous hat, against a corner of the seat, and she was keeping her eyes closed. Should he, Tanagra, respect this sleep, genuine or false as it might be, and retire? Or was it a consenting woman's device, which he should already know, for which he should somehow indicate gratitude? The point he had now reached admitted no hesitation. He could only advance. Private Tanagra's hand was small and plump, and its hard parts and calluses had become so blended with the muscle that it was uniform, flexible. The bones could not be felt, and its movement was made more with nerves, though gently, than with joints. And this little hand had constant and general and minuscule movements to maintain the completeness of the contact alive and burning. But when, finally, a first stirring ran through the widow's softness, like the motion of distant marine currents through secret underwater channels, the soldier was so surprised by it that, as if he really supposed the widow had noticed nothing till then, had really been asleep, he drew his hand away in fright. Now he sat there, with his hands on his own knees, huddled in his seat, as he had been when she came in. He was behaving absurdly, he realized that. With a scraping of heels, a stretching of hips, He seemed eager to reestablish the contacts, but this prudence of his was absurd, too, as if he wanted to start his extremely patient operation again from the beginning, as if he were not sure now of the deep goals already gained. But had he really gained them, or had it been only a dream? A tunnel fell upon them. The darkness became denser and denser, and Tanagra, first with timid gestures, occasionally drawing back as if he were really at the first advances and amazed at his own temerity, then trying more and more to convince himself of the profound intimacy he had already reached with that woman, extended one hand, shy as a pullet, toward her bosom, large and somewhat abandoned to its own gravity. And with an eager groping, he tried to explain to her the misery and the unbearable happiness of his condition, and his need of nothing else but for her to emerge from her reserve. The widow did react, but with a sudden gesture of shedding herself and rejecting him. A sudden gesture of shielding herself and rejecting him. It was enough to send Tanagra crouching in his corner, wringing his hands. But it was probably a false alarm caused by a passing light in the corridor, which had made the widow fear the tunnel was suddenly going to end. Perhaps, or had he gone too far, had he committed some horrible rudeness toward her, who had already been so generous toward him? No, by now there could be nothing forbidden between them, and her action, on the contrary, was a sign that this was all real, that she accepted, participated. Tanagra approached again. To be sure, in these reflections, a great deal of time had been wasted. The tunnel wouldn't last much longer, and it wasn't wise to allow oneself to be caught by the sudden light. Tanagra was already expecting the first grayness there on the wall. The more he expected, the more he expected it, the riskier it was to attempt anything. Of course, this was a long tunnel. He remembered it from other journeys as very, very long, and if he took advantage immediately, he would have a lot of time ahead of him. Now it was best to wait for the end. But it never ended, and so this had perhaps been his last chance. There, now the darkness was being dispelled. It was ending. They were at the last stations of a provincial line. The train was emptying. Some passengers in the compartment had already got out, and now the last ones were taking down their bags, leaving. Finally, they were alone in the compartment, the soldier and the widow, very close and detached, their arms folded, silent, eyes staring into space. Tanagra still had to think. Now that all the seats are free, if she wanted to be nice and comfortable, if she were fed up with me, she would move. Something restrained him and frightened him still. Perhaps the presence of a group of smokers in the passage, or a light that had come on because it was evening. Then he thought to draw the curtains on the passage, like somebody wanting to get some sleep. He stood up with elephantine steps. With slow, meticulous care, he began to unfasten the curtains, draw them, and fasten them again. When he turned, he found her stretched out, as if she wanted to sleep, even though she had her eyes open and staring. She had slipped down, maintaining her matronly composure intact, with a majestic hat still on her head, which was resting on the seat arm. Tanagra was standing over her. Still, to protect this image of sleep, he chose also to darken the outside window, and he stretched over her to undo the curtain. But it was only a way of shifting his clumsy actions above the impassive widow. Then he stopped tormenting that curtain snap and understood he had to do something else. show her all his own compelling condition of desire, if only to explain to her the misunderstanding into which she had certainly fallen. As if to say to her, you see, you are kind to me because you believe we have a remote need for affection, we poor lonely soldiers, but here is what I really am. This is how I received your courtesy. This is the degree of impossible ambition I have reached, you see, here. And since it was now evident that nothing could manage to surprise the lady, and indeed everything seemed somehow to have been foreseen by her, Private Tamagra could only make sure that no further doubts were possible. And finally the urgency of his madness managed also to grasp its mute object, her. When Tamagra stood up, and beneath him, the widow remained with her clear, stern gaze. She had blue eyes, with her hat and veil still squarely on her head, and the train never stopped, as shrill whistling through the fields. And outside, those endless rows of grapevines went on, and the rain that throughout the journey had tirelessly streaked the panes now resumed with new violence. He had again a brief spurt of fear, thinking how he, Private Tamagra, had been so daring. Oh, you listen to me, Norman Douglas. The name of the show, Good Night, Norman. The radio station, WGXC 90.7 FM in the upper Hudson Valley, particularly Greene and Columbia counties of New York, broadcasting to you from a tower in Accra on your way to Hunter. Me, I'm out here in the suburbs, far from the valley, but not. You can hear the show every first and third Sunday night, Monday morning. All fiction, all the time. Because what's truth these days? I'm going to check the time right here. It looks like I already spent half the show on that one story. I'm going to keep reading some, Calvino. That was from a book of stories called Difficult Loves. This It's from a book called Cosmic Comics. That's not. I'm not going to read from that because all the stories are too long. So it seems like I'm ill prepared, and I kind of am, but not really. Instead, I'm going to read from Calvino's compilation of Italian folktales. I guess these are kind of fairy tales, and that's appropriate in some ways. This is called The Crab Prince, a retelling of a folktale by a retelling by Italo Calvino and a rereading by me, your host, Norman Douglas, on this show, Good Night, Norman, WGXC.org. all around the world. The Crab Prince. There was once a fisherman who never could catch enough fish to buy food for his family. One day, though, when he went to pull up his nets, he felt a weight almost too heavy to move. But he tugged and tugged and found a crab so enormous that one pair of eyes was not enough to take it all in. Oh, what a haul at last. Now I can buy food for my children. He took the crab home on his back and told his wife to put on the fire, for he would return shortly with food. Then he carried the crab to the king's palace. "Your Highness," he said to the king, "I come to see if you will kindly buy this crab from me. My wife has put the pot on the fire, but I have no money to buy anything to go in it." The king replied, "But what would I do with a crab? Can't you sell it to someone else?" Just then the king's daughter came in. "Oh, what a fine crab. What a fine crab. Please buy it for me, Papa, please. We'll put it in the fish pond with the mullets and the goldfish." The king's daughter was fascinated by fish and would sit for hours on the rim of the fish pond in the garden watching the mullets and the goldfish swim about. Her father could refuse her nothing, so he bought the crab. The fisherman put it into the fish pond and received a purse of gold coins that would feed his children for a whole month. The princess never tired of watching the crab and spent all her time by the fish pond. She had become thoroughly familiar with him and his ways. Noticing that from noon until 3 o'clock, he always disappeared and went off goodness knows where. One day the king's daughter was there studying her crab when she heard the doorbell ring. She looked down from her balcony, and there was a poor tramp asking for alms. She threw down a purse of money, but it flew past him into a ditch. The tramp went into the ditch after it, plunged under the water, and began to swim. The ditch connected with the king's fish pond by an underground canal, which continued on as to no telling where. The tramp followed it and came out in a beautiful basin in the middle of a large underground hall hung with tapestries and containing a table sumptuously laid. The tramp stepped from the basin and hid behind the tapestries. At the stroke of noon, up popped a fairy in the middle of the basin, seated on the back of a crab. She and the crab jumped out of the water into the hall. The fairy tapped the crab with her wand, and there emerged from the crab shell a handsome youth. The young man took a seat at the table, and the fairy tapped her wand, producing food in the dishes and wine in the bottles. When the youth had finished eating and drinking, he re-entered the crab shell, which the fairy touched with her wand, and the crab took her onto his back once more, jumped into the basin, and disappeared underwater with her. Then the tramp came out from behind the tapestries, dove into the water, and swam back to the king's fish pond. The king's daughter was there looking at her fish, and seeing the vagabond's head bob up, she asked, "Well, what are you doing here?"
"Princess," said the tramp, "I have a wonderful thing to relate to you."
He came out of the pond and told her the whole story.
"Now I understand where the crab goes from noon to 3 o'clock," exclaimed the king's daughter. "Fine. Tomorrow at noon we shall go together and see."
And so the next day they both swam the underground canal from the fish pond to the underground hall and hid behind the tapestries. Exactly at noon up popped the fairy on the crab's back. She tapped her wand and out stepped the handsome young man from the crab shell and took his place at the table. The princess, who already liked the crab, was charmed with the young man and immediately fell in love with him. Seeing the empty crab shell right there next to her, she hid inside it. When the youth got back into the shell, he found the beautiful maiden there.
"Hey, what have you done?" he whispered. "If the fairy learns of this, she'll put us both to death."
"But I want to free you from the spell," whispered the king's daughter. "Tell me what I must do."
"Impossible," said the young man. "Only a maiden who loved me enough to die for me could break the spell."
"I am that maiden," said the princess. While this conversation was taking place inside the crab shell, the fairy seated herself on the crab's back, and the youth, working the crab claws as usual, carried her through the underground waterways to the open sea. Without her suspecting that hidden inside with him was the king's daughter. On the way back to the fish pond, after leaving the fairy at her destination, the young man, who happened to be a prince, explained to the beloved close beside him in the crab shell what to do to free him.
"You must climb up on a rock on shore and play and sing. The fairy is enthralled by music, and we will emerge from the sea to listen to you and say, 'Play on, lovely maiden, your music is so delightful.' And you will reply, 'I certainly shall, if you give me the flower in your hair. When you have that flower in your hand, I will be free, since the flower is my life.'"
Meanwhile, the crab had reached the fish pond, and he let the king's daughter out of the shell. The tramp had swum back by himself, and finding no princess, saw himself in serious trouble. But the maiden emerged from the fish pond, thanked him, and gave him a handsome reward. Then she went to her father and told him she wanted to study music and singing. The king, who never refused her anything, sent for the finest musicians and singers to give her lessons. As soon as she had learned music, the daughter said to the king, "Papa, I want to go and play my violin on a rock by the sea."
"On a rock by the sea? Have you lost your mind?"
But as usual, he gave in to her and let her go with 8 maids of honor dressed in white. As a precaution, he had her followed at a distance by a few armed soldiers. Seated on a rock with her 8 maids of honor in white dresses on 8 rocks around her, the king's daughter played her violin. From the waves rose the fairy.
"How beautifully you play," she said. "Play on, play on. It delights me so to hear you."
The king's daughter said, "Indeed I shall, if you make me a present of that flower you are wearing in your hair, for I love flowers to distraction."
"I will give it to you if you can fetch it from where I throw it."
"I will fetch it," she assured the fairy, and started to play and sing. When the song was over, she said, Now give me the flower."
"Here you are,"
said the fairy, and threw it as far as she could out to sea. The princess dove into the sea and swam toward the flower floating on the waves.
"Princess, princess, help, help,"
screamed the 8 maids of honor standing up on the rocks with their white veils blowing in the wind. But the princess swam on and on, disappearing in the waves and coming back up. She was beginning to doubt whether she would reach the flower when a big wave swept it right into her hand. In that instant, she heard a voice beneath her saying,
"You have given me back my life and will be my bride. Now don't be afraid. I am under you and I will carry you to shore. But say nothing of this, not even to your father. I must go and tell my parents, and within 24 hours I'll come and ask for your hand."
"Yes, yes, I understand," was all she could answer, since she was out of breath, while the crab underwater carried her to shore. So when she got back home, all the princess said, told the king, was that she had enjoyed herself immensely. The next day at 3, there was a roll of drums, a flourish of trumpets, a prancing of horses, and in walked a major domo, saying the son of his king requested an audience. The prince put the customary request to the king for the princess's hand and then told the whole story. The king was somewhat taken aback, for he had been in the dark about everything. He sent for his daughter, who came running in and threw herself into the prince's arms, exclaiming, "This is my bridegroom. This is my bridegroom." The king realized there was nothing to do but conclude the marriage as soon as possible. I don't know why I love fairy tales so much, but that's the end of that one. I mean, I guess it was a fairy tale because there was a fairy in it. But it's a folk tale from Venice, retold by Italo Calvino Vino in Italian sometime back in the late 50s, mid 60s era, and translated not long thereafter into English, an amazing volume, one of my favorite, called Italian Folk Tales by Italo Calvino. Okay, I think I have time for one more of those amazing tales. This is a pretty good one. The Dead Man's Palace. There was once a king who had a daughter. This is a kind of ongoing theme in a lot of these stories. Maybe I should tell a different one that doesn't have the king and the daughter, but usually a daughter or a son or three sons or three daughters. Of somebody, baker, widow, degenerate, itinerant. So we might as well read this one. The Dead Man's Palace. There was once a king who had a daughter. One day, the girl was on the balcony with her maids of honor when an old woman came walking by.
"My little lady," said the old woman, "be kind and give me something, won't you please?"
"Why, yes, of course, good soul," replied the maiden, and threw her down a bag of coins.
"My little lady, that's not much money. Won't you give me something more?"
The king's daughter threw down another bag. The old woman again said,
"Little lady, can't you give me still a little bit more?"
At that, the king's daughter lost her temper.
"You know what you are. You're a nuisance. That's what. I've given you money twice, and you're not getting a cent more."
The old woman then faced her and said,
"So, that's how it is, eh? I therefore call on heaven to prevent you from marrying until you have found the dead man."
The king's daughter went back inside and burst into tears. When her father learned why she was crying, he told her,
"Never give any of those old wives' tales a thought."
"I don't know what will become of me," she sobbed, "but I intend to depart in search of the dead man."
As you like, I give you up for lost," replied the king,
who then burst into tears himself. The girl paid no attention and set out. After days and days of walking, she came to a marble palace. The door stood open, and all the rooms were brightly lit. The girl walked in and called out, "Anybody home?" There was no answer. She went into the kitchen and found a pot of stew cooking on the stove. She opened the cupboard. It was full of provisions. "Since I'm already here, I may as well stay," she said, and sat down and ate, being quite hungry after all those days of traveling. When she had finished, she opened a door and saw a comfortable bed. "Well, I'm going to bed, and we'll see what tomorrow brings." The next morning, she awakened and resumed her tour of the palace. She opened every door until she finally found herself in a room in which a dead man lay. At his feet, a note said, "Whoever watches over me, a year, 3 months, and a week, my beloved bride shall be."
"So I found him I was seeking," murmured the girl. "All I have to do now is stick by him day and night."
And nor did she budge from there except to prepare her meals. Thus a year went by while she watched the dead man in solitude. Then one day a cry came up from the canal.
"Slave girls for sale! Slave girls for sale!"
"That's an idea," said the maiden. "I'll buy a slave girl right now. That way, I'll at least have company, and every now and then I can lie down and sleep for a few minutes. I'm so tired now, I could drop."
She went to the window, called to the slave dealer, and purchased one of his girls.
She then had the girl come upstairs and stay by her side at all times. 3 more months went by, and the maiden was so tired that she said to the slave girl, "I'm going to bed now. Let me sleep for 3 days, no more. Wake me up the 4th day. Be careful and don't mistake the day." "Don't worry, I won't," replied the slave girl. The maiden went to sleep, while the slave girl remained day and night with the dead man. 3 days passed, then 1 more, and the maiden slept on. The slave girl said to herself, "Do you think I'd awaken her? Let her sleep. Let her sleep." Time was up at last, and the dead man opened his eyes, saw the slave girl, embraced her, and said, "You shall be my bride." At those words, the whole palace sprang back to life. Servants came running from one wing, maids of honor, cooks, coachmen from the other. In short, there were people all over the place. The noise they made awakened the maiden, who realized she had slept a whole week. "I have been cheated," she exclaimed. "That evil soul failed to call me, and now I've lost my fortune. Cursed was the hour and the minute when I bought that slave." The dead man happened to be a king. He asked the slave girl, "Did you watch over me all this time by yourself?" "I brought in another woman for a few minutes every day, but at least she slept all the time and was a little use to me." "Well, where is she now?" asked the king. "In her room, sleeping as usual." So the king married the slave girl. But despite all the royal finery he had her dressed in, despite all the gold and the diamonds, she was still just as homely could be. The king held open house for a week. After dinner, it was his wish for the servants to join everybody else at the table for dessert, and he told his wife to be sure and invite the maid who had shared in her vigil. "I ain't about to do that," said the bride. In the first place, she wouldn't come, for all she does is sleep." On the contrary, all the poor maiden did was sigh and weep day and night over having slept one day too many and lost her fortune. At the end of the week of open house, the king announced he had to go away to look after his property, and that it was his custom on such occasions to bring back a present to every servant in the household. He sent for them all and asked them each what they wanted. Some said a kerchief, some an outfit, others a pair of breeches, others a cutaway coat. And he wrote down everything so as to forget nothing. He said to his wife, "Call that maid of yours and let me find out what she wants, because I'll bring her something too." The maiden was called in. The king found her so beautiful and genteel of face and speech that he was altogether charmed with her. "Tell me, my dear, what do you want me to bring you?" "Please be so good," sighed the maiden, "as to bring me a tinderbox, a black taper, and a knife." The king was dumbfounded by such a request. "Fine, fine, have no fear, I'll remember all 3 things." And he left, tended to his business, and then went to buy his servants' presents. Loaded down with all those purchases, he boarded his ship to sail back home. The ship weighed anchor, but could move neither forward nor back. The sailors asked, "Our venerable majesty, did you possibly forget something?" No, not a thing," he replied, but then he went over his notes and saw that he had forgotten the maiden's 3 presents. He disembarked at once, entered a shop, and requested the 3 items. The merchant looked him in the eye. "Excuse me for asking, but who'll receive these things?" "They're for one of my servants," replied the king. "Now listen carefully," said the merchant. "When you get home, don't give her anything, but make her wait 3 days. Then enter her room and say, 'Go get me a drink of water, and I'll give you the 3 presents.' As soon as she leaves the room, put them on a dresser and hide under the bed or in some other place where you can watch what she does." "I'll do just that," said the king. Upon his arrival, all the servants ran out to meet him, and he gave them each the present he'd promised. The last one in line was the maiden who asked if he'd bought her three presents. "You worrisome girl," he replied. "I bought them and I'll give them to you later." She returned to her room and cried, sure that he'd brought her nothing. Three days later, she heard a knock on the door, and there stood the king. "I'm here with your presents, but go get me a drink of water first, as I am thirsty." The girl ran off. The king put everything on the dresser and hid under the bed. When she returned and found the king gone, she said, "He's gone off once more without giving me anything." She put the water down on the dresser and spied the presents. Then she bolted the door, undressed, struck a light, and lit the black candle, which she placed on a little table. She picked up the knife and thrust it into the tabletop, saying, "Do you remember when I was back home with His Majesty, my father, and an old woman told me I wouldn't marry until I found the dead man?" The knife replied, "Indeed I do. Do you remember my traveling the world over and finding a palace with a dead man inside? Indeed I do. And you remember my watching him for a year and 3 months and then buying to keep me company that ugly slave I instructed to let me sleep for 3 days since I was tired and who let me sleep for a whole week only to have the dead man awaken, embrace her, and take her for his wife? I remember only too well, alas! Who should have been rewarded, myself who toiled a whole year and 3 months, or that woman who was there only a few days? You! Since you remember everything and say I deserve the prize, fly from the little table and lodge yourself in my heart." When the king heard the knife tearing loose from the table, he jumped out from under the bed, embraced the maiden, and said, "I heard everything. You shall be my wife. In the meantime, stay in your room and leave everything to me." He went to the slave girl and said, "Now that I'm back from my trip, I shall hold a week of open house." Just so you don't squander too much money on it," replied the slave. "But that has always been my custom every time I returned from a journey." There was a grand banquet. The king said to the slave, "I want all my servants to come in for dessert, and I want you to invite your maid, too. Can't you let that woman alone? She's so disagreeable. If you don't invite her, I will." Thus the maiden came to the table as cheerful as ever. When dinner was over, the king gave an account of his journey. He had visited a city, he said, whose king had been under a spell like the one he himself had been under. A maiden had watched him for a year and 3 months. Then she bought a slave to keep her company. Exhausted, the maiden went to sleep, and the slave girl failed to awaken her. The dead man woke up, saw the slave girl, and married her. Now tell me, everybody, which one should have been the king's bride? The one who watched for a week, or the one who watched for a year and 3 months?
The one who watched for a year and three months.
Agreed everyone. The king continued. Here, ladies and gentlemen, is the lady who watched for a year and 3 months. And here is the slave girl she bought. Tell me how this ugly motherfucker should die in her shameful treachery. They all jumped to their feet, clamoring, "Burn her! Burn her! Burn her!" in the middle of the town square in a cauldron of flaming pitch. It was done. The king married the maiden, and they lived happily ever afterward. Nor was any more ever said about them. All right, you've been listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas. Good night, Norman. WGXC 90.7 FM. That was some fairy tales. to bring you into the heat of the summer. Well, it won't be summer next time I go on the air. Still spring. Springtime. Springtime again. Okay, that's it. I have told you fictions.